I go now to the wonderful human being that is Athol Williams. Athol, hi. Thank you so much for being on Cape Talk.
Hi, Lindsay. Wonderful to join you again.
Yes. I mean, last time I was talking to you, you were coming back and you were so busy with your Read to Rise program that it was almost a push to get your master's completed, but that you have completed and with distinction.
Yes, I have. I'm as overwhelmed and as ecstatic as anyone else. For me, just to complete it was a miracle, as you say. To have earned a distinction for it is quite amazing.
I was telling Kaketso that for me you are inspirational and that you embody the spirit of Madiba. There's something about the way that you have lived your life and the integrity with which you live your life. The fact that you have dreams and you have goals, you've lived your life, but you've also given back to people, and you've had this goal to study in all these five big universities, but you've made your studies relevant, which is so important, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, to be compared or to draw any comparison with Madiba is always a bit sort of, feel like it's a bit too much. But I draw massive inspiration from him, Lindsay. I often see these pictures this time of year as we're celebrating his birthday, of people kind of showing pictures of having met him and having spoken to him. And I never met him. I never spoke to him. And that doesn't bother me. What matters more to me is that I can contribute to his legacy of the work he started and the vision he had for South Africa.
And I tell you why the comparison is so important. There's something about you. It's not just about you uplifting yourself, because clearly you are uber capable. It's about the fact that it's not just about empowering yourself, it's about empowering others, and that you want people to dream about what they could be, not what they are, and that's what sticks out for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've captured that quite well. I mean, that is exactly my view. I think we as humans and as South Africans have such amazing possibilities. I think we've got infinite capabilities most of the time, and we've lived in a world that's kind of told us that there are all these limitations. Mm-hmm. And once I think we free ourselves from that mindset that says I'm limited and I can't, I think we can do amazing things. Often I talk about this idea of why not me, right? Someone's got to win the gold medal, why not me? And to present that, this idea of openness and possibility rather than things we can't do and shouldn't do and rules, I think that's where possibility and that's where progress lives, I think.
But it's also that when we work on ourselves and when we live with integrity, it spreads. And that's what I liked about your thesis that you've just completed at Oxford, the whole idea of focusing on corporations, and it's not just what you do with the profit, it's how you make the profit. And
absolutely.
Not to perpetuate problems, but being part of solutions, which is so important. And that's for me why you're the man with a plan, because it's about thinking of the future.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, my thesis and my research is not an attempt to badger corporations and to join the sort of chorus of people speaking against corporations. And there are many issues corporations have. What I try to do was imagine, and I give myself the space to imagine a society that I really wanted to live in. And I think, again, I wasn't focused on South Africa per se, but I think in South Africa we certainly spend a lot of time having to think about how things can be better. And the one assumption I think corporations operate under and capitalism encourages is actually that you're operating in a level playing field, that you operate in a society where there are just institutions so that you can have a winner-takes-all type economic system. And of course, in a place like South Africa and in most societies around the world, this isn't the case. And so if you as a business are operating in an environment where there are deprivations, where there are people living with deprivation. And I was less focused on financial and resource deprivation and more focused actually on human capital deprivation, right? So if there's Bob, who is 60 years old, who never had an opportunity to earn an education, to develop a skill, he suffers a deprivation today that is very hard for us to actually fill for him, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we stole Bob's car, we can return the car to him.
Exactly.
And even in South Africa, we're talking about land being returned. We can return physical land. But if we've deprived someone of the ability to fully develop their talents, I think that's a harder thing to try now rectify Bob's situation. And I believe that in South Africa and in many other societies, that's the environment in which we operate. And so for corporations to operate with a focus on profit alone, I felt was missing an important part of their moral obligation to society.
And it also, you know, the sense that a lot of corporations, they make the money however they see fit, and they say, what do you want from me? I'm happy to give back. And I like your thinking. It's more than that. It's rethinking that. It's about, think about how you're making the profit, and think, you know, we're way past the pup suck days and those kind of days, but we are still in days where corporations do sometimes take advantage with minimum wages, for example. But you're talking about lost potential and uplifting people, which we're in desperate need of, especially in times when a lot of people are unemployed. And you know, it reminds me a little bit about the gangs. They make this money through crime, and then they want to be seen as the guys that you go to for help, and they have this incredible largesse. So with the same money that they've made from destabilizing the community, they're going to help you get a new dress for your confirmation. You know, and it's, I mean, that's obviously a really ridiculous comment, but it feels to me a little bit like sometimes companies do that. They say, what do you want from us? We're putting money back in. But it's about really thinking about capitalism, whatever color you ascribe it to, but with integrity.
Absolutely. And I think your idea about integrity is a powerful one. And this idea that, you know, I think most corporations see their social responsibility as charity rather than something they have an obligation to do, right? And for me, on the other side of running an NGO where I'm approaching corporations for funding or for support, I often feel that I'm going to them, you know, with hat in hand, asking for their money rather than saying, I am part of the solution. Yes. You should be enabling me to help you solve the social problem.
Yes. And you get away from the reluctance. I'm doing this, but reluctantly, you know.
Exactly. So, what I've been encouraging corporations in thinking about some of this research I've been doing is saying, well, two things. Consider the social context within which you operate, right? Now, in South Africa, what we basically have implemented a US-style form of capitalism. Most of us, myself included, have gone to American business schools, we go to Harvard Business School, we read American business books, and we believe that's capitalism. Well, that's just one form of capitalism. Mm. There are many other forms of capitalism. In Germany, they practice a very different form of capitalism where labor is far more involved in decision-making. In Korea, the same thing. Mm. So I would say, think about the social context within which you operate. We operate in a very unjust society. And so we run the risk as corporations of perpetuating some of those injustices. The second thing I always suggest to executives is think about the history of your organization. Because if your organization was involved in perpetrating injustices, then I argue you owe society a moral debt. And just as you've got financial debt, which you've got to pay back, and the longer you take to pay it back, the more the interest rises, the same with moral debt. And so if we believe this idea of moral debt, then it isn't charity to go and invest in upliftment of communities or to go and help develop your supply chains or to support, you know, some government initiative. It's actually an obligation that the corporation acquires because of its historical involvement in injustices.
Of course, once again, then that sense of debt and obligation. I quite like your idea of getting in with the youngsters, teaching, mentoring that you do, and suggesting that your whole business model should be looking at incorporation with communities and should be looking at human capital, growing people, serving communities, so that we don't end up with a whole little cluster of obscenely rich people and then a whole lot of have-nots on the other side of the spectrum.
That's exactly right. The area that I try and sort of poke at in that respect, Lindsay, is this idea that says business is separate from society, right? And you go to conferences of business in society, or people taking courses business in society. For me, business is part of society. So when I start a business, I don't suddenly now become separate from society. And yet that's the way we've accepted that business somehow has got license to do things separately from the way society operates. And, you know, an example would be, you know, in my normal life, lying would be wrong. But yet when you go into business and, you know, someone's lying, you say, oh, well, you know, street smart, you know, businessman, or quite an astute business person, because we somehow have a lower expectation of levels of just basic things, right? Mm. And part of what I'm trying to encourage is saying, I want to stop this distinction between who Athol is at home, where he cares about human rights and cares about fairness and cares about people. Then he crosses the road to go to his office, and there he doesn't care about human rights and doesn't care about people. I want to get rid of that distinction and say, I'm still the same person. I should operate with the same level of morality, whether I'm in business or whether I'm at home.
Of course, you're a role model. There you are at the top of the pile, and with all the trappings of wealth that many people aspire to. And at that point, you made a significant shift.
It was a significant shift in that I decided I wanted to get out of just living a life of indulgence, partly because, again, this idea of social context, right? Mm-hmm. I felt it to be an absurdity to be living a life of massive indulgence when around me there was this massive poverty and massive need. I see nothing wrong, Lindsay, with people enjoying the fruits of their work. So this was a very personal choice for me to say I wanted to not be caught up in all of these trappings. But secondly, also, I wanted to free myself. I wanted to, you know, use my resources, you know, in a far more productive way, and that's why my wife and I started Read to Rise, where we could invest the money and energy we had into something very, very hopeful and positive around inspiring children to learn, rather than, you know, driving a big, you know, a big luxury car.
And of course, once again, that's for me, a man with a plan. It's about looking to the future, because if you grow the desire of youngsters to read, the world is open. The doors are open. I mean, you have achieved what no one else is going to achieve. I mean, because I don't know, in the mix of the degrees you've got at Harvard, MIT, Oxford, London Business School, the WITS is the one that no one else is going to trump. So you've blazed a trail that I'm sure no one's going to come close to. The reality is that reading is a gateway to knowledge, and you know, with knowledge, you can be part of solutions instead of stuck in a sort of desperateness and poverty consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many parts of, you know, the modern society, you know, education is just the basics, right? The ability to read is just basic. Recently I was reminded that if you can't read, you actually can't even read the label on your medication. So how does someone even take their tablets if they don't know what they're reading? So it's so fundamental to be able to read. And yet we've got 50% of our grade fours are functionally illiterate in South Africa. Mm. And for me, that is just, you know, a human rights violation. We cannot say we are creating free citizens in our country when we haven't equipped them to do the basic things like read, let alone then go into advanced study. So for me, it's often suggest to folks, you know, the goal isn't to emulate what I've done. It's to emulate the idea of following your passion. So I love, you know, learning. I love studying. I love reading. I love trying to explore new ideas, and that's my passion. You know, that's my Wade for Nikkei thing, right? If you're an athlete, go and be an amazing athlete. If you're going to be a doctor, be an amazing doctor. So find your passion. But I would still agree with you that foundational to all of that is the idea of having a basic education.
Mm. And it's also about opening your mind to new possibilities. If you're stuck in a situation where you don't have many doors open to you, you don't have many opportunities, there's something about the written word that opens your world into the realm of, well, fantasy on the one hand and a very practical way out of it on the other.
Yeah. I think also it contributes to you being an active and productive citizen. I think in a democracy where we rely on people's participation in public discourse and in making wise, you know, voting decisions, when someone can read and think critically, I think it makes for a better democracy. And I think that's in areas where our democracy has kind of fallen flat in some spaces because we seem unable to really engage critically with things around us and have proper debates.
And sadly, of course, that's the mess we're finding ourselves in, our political situation at the moment, where if people don't get their way, there's the yell of fake news, threats not so lightly veiled, and violence. And you think on a day like today, when we're reflecting on the legacy of Madiba, for me, we need to remember that there are people like yourselves who have this think tank approach to the future, which is not, first of all, political, although there's it's the you're thinking about money, and for many people money is political, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I think, and of course, you know, to not oversimplify things, because I think we face many complexities in South Africa, I understand the frustration that is building up in many parts of our society of people just saying, look, literally my life has not improved much in the last 25 years. And I'm just getting more and more frustrated. And I think when someone feel they don't have the voice or the channel through which they express themselves, that's when they turn to destructive behavior. And I think that's sad but understandable. And I think the longer we take to address some of our fundamental social and economic challenges, I think we shouldn't be surprised to expect more sort of violent outbreaks. What I'm hoping is we can, as we were saying a few minutes ago, begin to have that very sophisticated and mature types of discourse where we can address some of these issues, as opposed to either flinging fake news or the race card or dismissing each other.
Make a point. Make it well, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I worry that we are losing respect for each other very quickly. And that worries me, because the moment we lose respect for each other, we don't see each other's dignity. I think then it becomes so much easier to treat people with disdain, and that then leads to, you know, very ugly consequences. We need to, and I think that's one of the legacies Mandela left with us of seeing everyone, even his captors, even the people who held him in prison, seeing them as human, treating them with respect and dignity, and then still disagreeing fundamentally with around ideas.
And for me, the focal part of what he did and did differently is listen.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, you know, your book, Pushing Boulders, you told me last time that it was written in a rush, but it has been an inspiration to so many people.
Yeah, it's been so rewarding, that, Lindsay. It's been overwhelming how rewarding that has been in people saying, and people from all walks of life saying different parts of it resonated with them. So whether it was where I grew up and people who grew up in similar circumstances or people who faced, you know, different types of challenges but had to deal with challenges as well. But the idea, again, of saying I'm going to face these boulders, and it's up to me through my resilience and self-belief to push those boulders aside. But I only do that if I've got this vision or this dream on the other end of it to actually make me want to go through the effort of pushing it.
Mm. Now, you had the employees of Fashini being involved with your Read to Rise. Do you call it a foundation or campaign?
It's an
NGO. Okay. So you know, you've got people paying attention about your NGO. For listeners who might not have heard about Read to Ride, I know what it is. Remind us what it is and tell us about the Oki books that you're getting out to the schools.
Ah, yes. So in its simple form, Read to Rise is an NGO that promotes youth literacy in under-resourced communities. So we work in Mitchell's Plain, which is where I attended school and grew up. We work in Soweto and then in other communities around Gauteng and Western Cape and Limpopo. But more than that, it is an effort to inspire young children, mainly grade twos and threes and fours, to rise above their circumstances. And this is the essence then, right? So it's about reading and literacy, but at the same time, it's about looking that seven-year-old child in the eye and say, I know the circumstances you're living in, and they don't look good ahead of you. But if you can be inspired, we believe that you can rise above those obstacles. So the stories we use, so these Oki books, actually I've written the four Oki books, and my wife Karen has illustrated them. We specifically choose these stories to have some strong message in them. So the one book is Oki the Happy Tree. And it's a simple story, but in the story, it's about how Oki is tempted to be something other than a tree. And the message is, no, you are unique. You need to be happy. The happiest you can be is when you are who you are. And we know children are faced with so many distractions and so many temptations today. And so these young ages already, we're trying to sow good seeds that can be watered over time, trying to inspire them to live, to rise above their circumstances, and at the same time investing in their literacy, because again, literacy is so fundamental.
Athol, are you coming back to South Africa now that you've completed and ticked off your list, now that you've done and dusted and Oxford is in your past?
I'm actually not immediately, Lindsay. I will continue to do a doctorate. So I'll be visiting South Africa as I do very often. So I'll be there from mid-August to mid-September. But I have been invited to continue to do a doctorate along the same lines of my master's thesis.
Okay, so you're not going to stop.
Well, this is sort of a running joke with anyone who kind of meets me, right? The guy with 6 degrees, it seems a bit ridiculous. But I see it as an investment I've made over the last few years because I wanted to think deeply about these issues. I wanted to use all of my business background, but I wanted to think deeply about political theory, about public administration. And so for me, this period of studying is a period of reflection and a period of training. I want to be able to train myself to think deeply about these issues facing societies so that when I am advising government or advising corporations or lecturing at a university, it's not some superficial stuff. It's stuff that I've thought about deeply. And I take that quite seriously because I think, we've had some examples of people with fake degrees and fake qualifications and a lot of fake things going on around us. I at least wanted to make sure that I was being honest with myself and honest with the people I'll deal with in saying I've got some real fundamental ideas and well thought through ideas before presenting them.
And as you say, it's almost the discipline of your mind, and it's about taking it further, because once you've met that goal, you are somebody who's driven. You're not going to stop. I've got an SMS that's come in saying, "Hi there, Athol. Myself and my entire family are still awake, tuned in, and I am one of your biggest fans." It's from Layla, my daughter. I'm not sure whose daughter, but anyway, that's how it's written. And it ends, "Thank you for inspiring us." I'm sure you get a lot of messages like that.
I do. I never know how to respond to that, but it's wonderful to know that the simple things that I do and say can have some value to others. And so thank you for the message. I'm glad that I can. I always find it an incredible responsibility when people are kind of watching what you're doing and saying, because I go, I'm fallible. I screw up often, and I'm going to keep screwing up often. So I hope I don't disappoint too many people.
Well, I think the point about being real is also that we learn that we're real, and it's in our humanity that we all grow together. Because otherwise we are, the kind of things you've achieved, people would think you were completely somebody who we can't relate to. And I think that's why you inspire and resonate for me, like Madiba does, because of your approachability. The SMS has had another attachment, and it is actually from Khadija Nudin and the rest of the clan. And your biggest fan is Layla, who is Khadija's daughter. Thank you for clarifying that, Khadija. I love it when people respond so quickly.
That's brilliant. In fact, Layla is one of the characters in our new Oki book. shout out to Layla.
Well, let's go back to Read to Rise. You were talking about that. And my question to you is, you were involved in business, you know, this big shot, fancy, spancy cars and on the boards. And then you go to work with this NGO. Do you get patronized by some business people who tend to treat directors of NGOs with a slightly different respect? Or do you think you've earned your cred and people treat you because of that?
I've got this big smile on my face as you ask that question. because it's, no, it's shocking to me how much disrespect I think we do treat people working in NGOs and working in charities and working to take care of the basic needs of people. In South Africa, it's often seen as someone who's failed at everything else. You then end up, you know, doing some of these basic things. Mm. Whereas I think in other parts of the world, it has matured enough where someone will have a Harvard degree and then go and run an NGO. I still keep having, you know, business friends of mine or colleagues of mine kind of say to me, you know, well, obviously you're struggling to get a job. That's why you're, you know, working and reading to children.
And that's so not the case.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I really think it should be our best minds should be applied to some of these major social ills we face. And yet often, even within large corporations, who are the people often, not always, but often we kind of send to the CSI department, right? It's not your best actuary or your best accountant or your best engineer. And I think that's part of why we're struggling with these things, Lindsay, is that we're not applying our best resources, our best minds to some of these big challenges. And I'm not saying I'm necessarily one of those, but I think it's a mindset. You know, going to ask people at university when they grow up what they want to be, and very few are saying, I want to run a literacy NGO or I want to run an NGO kind of, you know, fighting poverty.
Or I'm going to teach people to start becoming businesses and corporations that are making profit in an ethical way.
Yeah, absolutely not. And that's what I think needs to begin changing. And I think there's room for that. You know, I'm not a socialist or communist, and I have wonderful debates with people who support communism or socialism. I still believe that within capitalism, there's a huge amount of space for us to still pursue returns and pursue profit, but do it in a far more ethical way, do it in a way that recognizes people as humans, and not just factors of production. And I think that the more we speak that language, I think the more it will become attractive and become something that the people accept. And I think it's growing in South Africa. The idea of running an NGO or working at a social enterprise is growing. And I think there's becoming more and more of a distaste, I think, of exuberant indulgence. You know, I mean,
you didn't answer the question. Do you get treated with the NGO short shrift, or do people go on the kind of connection they had with you before you went to Read to Rise?
Well, I get largely treated with short shrift. I think when people realize,
when they realize actually who you are,
yes.
Do they get embarrassed?
Yeah, no, exactly. But I, you know, and that's not how I want to present myself. Yeah. I want someone to respect myself and my colleagues, because it's not about me. It's about the work we're doing and the people we're serving.
Yeah.
And so I know when we walk into a room to present our work, you know, there's a people kind of looking at us, probably rolling their eyes, thinking, oh, you know, a bunch of, you know, sort of tree hugging hippies.
Yeah.
If need be, I do emphasize my background and, you know, what I've done is going to further my cause. And I think that's part of it, right? That's the reason we have, you know, former Miss South Africa's involved in charity work. It's because they can use the influence or the position or the relationships to make things happen. And so I certainly do that. I mean, I call on my business relationships all the time for the purposes of Reach Arise or other social good.
Renee August has not only SMS'd, but she's also sent a WhatsApp. She really wanted to make sure I was going to get this message through to you. And thank you for that, Renee. It's that kind of commitment. She says, "Hi, Athol. I'm so proud of you and grateful for your life and example. What do you think is one of the top five issues in South Africa that we have to address in order to improve our democracy?"
Oh, wow. Great question. I think I can mention two things. I think one is the simple idea of respect I talked about earlier. I'm very concerned that we are losing our respect for each other's humanity and dignity. And so I think we need to see leadership in this space, leadership in government, in business, in all walks of life, not accepting when we treat each other with disrespect. I think that's a very important aspect. The second one I'd say, Rena, is a very practical idea, I think, around education. I think the more we can educate, inform, I think, everyday citizens around the world around them, I think we become better citizens and have a stronger democracy. You know, I know that we're all worried about corruption because corruption is very topical in South Africa right now. And of course, we must deal with the corruption. But that doesn't mean once the corruption's sorted, everything's going to be perfect. Mm. You know, I think if we had a young Mandela running South Africa, we'd still have major problems. And so I think, you know, the third thing I would mention to Renee would be around us being very serious about addressing, I mentioned this idea of moral debt earlier, but some of these real issues in our country which we haven't dealt with. You know, I think, Lindsay, we had the TRC and then kind of had this attitude that said, okay, we've now done the TRC, everyone can vote, South Africa's free. And I think that's obviously not the case. There's still a lot of hurt, there's still a lot of people who feel hard done by, right? And in my analogy, if I've stolen your car, not only do you want your car back, but it really grates you when you see me driving your car every day past you. I think that's an analogy for a lot of the suffering that's happened in the country, and we haven't dealt with these things. And so we can't move forward until we can begin to address some of the real hurt in the country.
Once again, you and I can talk and time flies by. How do people get hold of you? I know that you are much sought after to speak around the world. What's the easiest way of getting hold of you?
My website is athelwilliams.com, and so and my contact details are there. Or email is athelwilliams@hotmail.com. And I love interacting with people, so I'd be happy to consider opportunities to do that.
And if people want to contribute towards Read to Rise, tell us what it costs to speak around the world. What's the easiest way of getting hold of you?
My website is athelwilliams.com, and so and my contact details are there. Email is athelwilliams@hotmail.com. And I love interacting with people, so I'd be happy to consider opportunities to do that.
And if people want to contribute towards Read to Rise, tell us what it costs to sponsor a book.
So to sponsor a book and to sponsor our program to deliver to a child costs just 50 rand. So you know, that's the cost of, I don't know, I know you're in Oxford, it's probably two cups of coffee. So 50 rand allows us to give a child a brand new reading book and allows us to go into their classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, they own the book, you're right.
Yeah.
And allows us to go into their classroom at school and deliver this amazing, high-energy, inspirational reading program. Mm. Just 50 rand. And then you go to readtorise.org is our website.
So for those people who have been inspired and want to contribute in the spirit of Mandela Day, they can get hold of you. Thank you so much. I hope that you enjoy the beginning of your doctorate. I'm sure I'll hear you saying, "I need to focus on getting my doctorate out." And once again, congratulations on your master's.
Thank you so much, Lindsay. Appreciate it.
Thank you.